Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land.
I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the True Crime Review podcast, where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. We'd love it if you would subscribe to our feed. Please go to robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. You'll get your true crime on Tuesdays, as well as helping keep this program going.
If you've already subscribed, thank you. It makes a big difference. Sarah, what are we watching this week?
Well, let's open today's file. We watched Lowcountry, the Murdoch dynasty on HBO Max. That surname is said in various ways throughout the docuseries. We will probably give it a bit of a red hot go. It's directed by Moore Lushi and Danielle Sylvan. They previously worked together on Camp Confidential, America's Secret Nazis, which we've spoken about briefly on the program before, and the Oslo Diaries. But we can't venture into the Lowcountry without our guest. She's our first four-timer from the Extra Hot Great podcast and Exhibit B Bookshop. Yes, it's Sarah D. Bunting. Sarah, welcome to the scene.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. A four-timer.
Mm-hmm. You might as well just pull up a seat. Just
I know, right? Put a little plaque on my director's chair. Very exciting.
Yes. We're not going to get into sending people hats, but if we did, you'd just have one more click to collect the set.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So before we get to our main feature, we've got a little bit of a whip around of updates. Sarah, you have a true crime update that we're hanging on some information for tomorrow.
I do. Apparently, the boy in the box case, this was a small child of indeterminate age and anonymity who was found in the late 50s in Philadelphia. Apparently, genetic forensics have identified this child. And Philadelphia PD is going to make an announcement on that, I believe, December 2nd. And then they're going to start working the case. They apparently have a rock solid identity. His headstone will hopefully be updated, and we're going to get some updates on that. And hat tip to my esteemed colleague, Sarah Weinman, for tipping us all to that on Twitter this morning.
Wow. Fantastic. And Mari, you have an update as well.
Yes, the Lady of the Dunes has been identified. A body found in 1974 in Massachusetts has been identified as that of Ruth Marie Terry of Tennessee. The FBI notified the public of her identity back in November 3rd, so a few weeks ago. So they, now that they have her identity, they are now going to, again, just like with the boy in the box, continue the case. So, I mean, two like long-standing, like 50 plus years, like cold cases have now have victims who are identified, which means hopefully now that we have the victims' identities, we can now start to find the perpetrators. So, I mean, just major breakthroughs in true crime this week.
Yeah. Ears peeled for my recommendation, which also is a show about a cold case, although the head detective said, for me, it was never cold, solved in Australia, but we'll get to that. I have an update. At your first appearance, Sarah, way back in episode 2, when we were young, we watched a very curious episode of Unsolved Mysteries for various reasons. We learnt that Mari likes her mysteries solved. Mm-hmm. So that was the end of our Unsolved Mysteries dive. This was episode 16 from season 2, and Robert Stack told us about Georgia Rudolph and her claim to be the reincarnation of a girl who had lived early last century called Sandra Jean Jenkins. She had a short life, falling in love with Tommy Hicks, who impregnated her and promptly died, and then she completed suicide to avoid the shame of being an unwed mother. I have a slightly light tone because this is Georgia's recalling of her previous life, insert skeptical eyebrow raise there. Wonderful listener Shondell was inspired by our episode, unlike Mari, to start a rewatch of Unsolved Mysteries, and she alerted us to season 3, episode 7, shout out Renap, on the RHAP network,
yeah,
which had an update to Georgia Rudolph's story. What do you know? A fellow by the name of Jack Tunick discovered under hypnosis that he was the incarnation of Tommy Hicks. Ta-da! The original hypnotherapist who examined Georgia also regressed Jack. And I will read his conclusions verbatim. Something very definite is going on, but we have no rational explanation that science can provide. Challenge taken up many years later. Of course, I turned to crime scene's resident skeptic, Professor Peter Miller, for comment. It was an extremely extensive comment, so I will read part of it. So wait, what? A person remembers something in a past life that can't in any way be categorically corroborated? How is that in any way an indication that something is going on? Science actually can completely explain what's happening here. It's made up bullshit. It's prof, don't hold back. And he goes on. But even if we were prepared to accept all that Jack Tunick claimed as something he honestly believed happened, there are still valid scientific explanations. Number one would be that he's simply deluded. He somehow convinced himself that he was Tom Hicks in a past life, in inverted commas. Two would be that hypnosis is problematic in that even the most careful of hypnotists can lead their subject, and it is now well known that the subject so led can come to have actual memories of the alleged event. Both these explanations are more credible than jumping straight to people can remember past lives and science can't explain why. Both of those explanations should have been ruled out before the one that breaks the laws of reality as we know it. Yours skeptically, P. Thanks, Pete.
Yeah. I mean, we just know a lot more now than we used to about how memories work and are imprinted and can be suggested. And yeah, I mean, I don't want to ruin anyone's fun. And if people need to believe these things, I don't think it really hurts anyone. But this is beyond. Like, find another segment. Find some separated twins, please, Robert Stack, and don't encourage this kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, as we said at the time in episode two, we feel, you know, pity and fellow feeling for poor Georgia because she, I don't want to say she's a figure of pity, but the poor lady, in my opinion, was deluded and could have used a bit of a hug. As I recall, she had a tricky childhood and, you know, she just needed more hugging. Mari?
Yeah. I think SDB put it like plainly, it's like if there are people out here who want to believe this, then that is their cup of tea. Like I said, and we reviewed the episode, this is not my cup of tea at all. So
it was not.
You know, it did not hurt. As long as you don't hurt anybody, sure. Why not? Past lives and such.
Yes. All right. So let's get to the main feature. I'm going to try and summarize the crime so that we can discuss the documentary and how it's made more fully.
Crimes.
Crimes. The Myrtle family is a prominent legal family in the Low Country region of South Carolina. From 1920 to 2006, three successive members of the family served as district attorney, which is called solicitor there. Mm-hmm. Since 2014, Alec, also called Alex, it's spelled Alex, it's said predominantly Alec, I think we'll use. Alec Murdaugh and other members of the family have been involved in investigations involving several murders, corruption, and other alleged crimes, including insurance fraud, defrauding clients, defrauding the dead, which I didn't know was a crime, but apparently it is, so stop doing it if you are, theft of insurance payouts, and drug-related crimes. Okay, here we go. In 2015, Alex's son Buster may or may not have been involved in the murder of 19-year-old Stephen Smith and disguised the deed as a hit and run. In 2018, Alex's wife Maggie and their son Paul and a family dog may or may not have been involved in the death of their longtime housekeeper, Gloria Sutterfield. Alex certainly embezzled a $4.3 million insurance payout that should have gone to her sons. This is the only crime that he has actually confessed to. In 2019, Paul may or may not have been driving a boat intoxicated, collided with a bridge and killed a 19-year-old, Mallory Beach. Mallory Beach certainly died, sadly. His family may or may not have pressured the other four teenagers in the boat to say that Paul was not driving. In 2021, Alec may or may not have fatally shot his wife Maggie and his son Paul, and certainly they were murdered. Later in 2021, Alec may or may not have conspired with Curtis Smith to have Curtis kill him to provide a life insurance payout to Buster, his older son. Fearing that if he completed suicide, there would be no payout, Alec did survive being shot in the head, though it is apparently unusual in those parts for someone to miss if they are intending to kill something or someone. As of August 2022, Alec Murdaugh faces a total of 97 grand jury criminal charges. He has been disbarred, his assets seized, and is currently incarcerated. Ooh! Mm. And that's a summary.
That's a doozy. That's what that is.
Yeah.
Sarah, get us started. What's your overall big picture on the Murdaughs and this documentary, Low Country?
Well, when this Gordian knot of felonery first came to my attention a few months ago, I said something to the effect on my True Crime Reviews newsletter, Best Evidence. I said something like, if this eventual docuseries isn't 16 parts long, I will eat my hat. And then when I reviewed Low Country, I was like, well, someone roll a sombrero and some hot sauce out here, because somehow they got it done in three parts. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think they did a good job sort of trying to take you through chronologically, like, why is this family important? Why is this particularly shocking for this part of the country? Blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And this is such a complicated list of crimes, and some of them may be related to some others, and we're just never going to know because so many of the people who would know are dead now. But the docuseries, I mean, I happened to be watching it with a colleague at the same time a colleague of mine was, and we were like, we're not sure if this is compelling because of the subject or because of the documentary. And I think it's the first thing, because the frustrating thing about this is it kind of is not over yet. Like, the story is like 85% done, and it wraps up with Alec going into court and sort of changing his plea, I think. And then there was another update, and they have said that they may do a follow-up episode, but I kind of felt like this needed to be disposed of, at least in part, in court before they brought out this documentary. But it is so watchable. But I'm interested to hear what you guys think about why that is. And is it just the bonkosity of the subject matter? Because I think maybe that's it. What did you guys think? Yeah,
I think that's going to be the question of this podcast, Mari.
Mm-hmm. So for me, several things. This is one of those cases where it's like, I was following it as it was happening. Plus, I've already listened to the really great podcast. I'll plug it in our recommendations about it. And then I watched on Discovery back in the summer, the Murdaugh murders, Deadly Dynasty on ID.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a three-parter. And honestly, to answer your question, SDB, I think it's the subject matter, to be quite honest, because that docuseries, just like this one, was also three parts, and it was laid out almost the exact same way. And I was entertained watching both. I think I do tend to like the first one a little bit more, because I remember when I had watched it, I told Sarah, I was like, wow, this is a really good property. We might be able to fit it in, but it was in the middle of one of our breaks and we just kind of kept moving forward. But I think it's the way that it unravels. I think it just comes down to the way the story unravels, because like Anthony Cook says in this docuseries, what happened with Mallory Beach and the boat crash is what really unraveled this chain of craziness. You know what I'm saying? Because if that boat crash had never occurred, then none of the dominoes would have fell into place where like Alec Murdoch is now, you know, facing trials. I mean, plus a whole bunch of people wouldn't have died as well. But like it was, it was kind of like the first domino.
As a side, yes.
As a side, yes.
the number of dead people hanging off this story is, I mean, some order of magnitude from the ones that I mentioned in the summary. These are the ones that we can sort of hold in our heads at one time, I think. Mm-hmm. But they didn't go back to the original.
The 2015.
Buster. The original Buster. This is four generations of Murdaugh men.
We
only deal with the crimes of two generations of them. Although we do see a grandfather, Randolph, having some influence in the courts. I have questions, and I think the question about, okay, it's certainly very watchable. I really enjoyed watching it. I had no trouble watching it. I wasn't restless. I was gripped. I gasped, as I'm sure the filmmakers wanted me to do at appropriate moments. They end episode one and episode two, not quite on a cliffhanger, but on a, but wait, there's more. And you go, oh my God, every time you see that microfiche scrolling past, kids ask your great grandparents, scrolling past the newspaper headlines, you think, what am I going to see now? And it was always something surprising to me, despite the fact that I did listen to that very excellent podcast, as you did. Let's get into the structure of it. Sarah mentions it's three episodes. We're famously, we question whether something needs to be three episodes. It's often 90 minutes in a three-hour bag. Here it was full from side to side. Mari, you're the anti-three episodes. How did you feel about three for this one?
Like SDB said, it could have been a few more, to be quite honest. I would have loved for them to kind of fleshed out the dynasty itself. I would have loved just like a little bit more backstory about the former Murdaughs, because come on, this didn't just start right here. Like, let's be real. So I would have loved a little bit more of about the back story, but honestly, like I said, this was literally the exact same structure as the Murdaugh Deadly Dynasty. So I wasn't surprised. I liked the three episodes. This is definitely not one that you would put in a long documentary. There's no way. There's too much. It's too much going on.
Agree.
Agree.
I mean, I think part of it too is not just the subject matter and how it's this. I think on in my review, I called it like a rancid blooming onion of cases that just keep folding and unpeeling. But like, there is something about this particular kind of silver magnolia, born with a silver magnolia in their mouth, Southern family with people named things like Buster and Taffy that you're just like, I'm not proud of it, but I'm not unhappy when shitty things happen to them. And there is something about, like, my colleague Mark and I were just texting, like, I exactly knew these dudes of that last generation in university. And he is actually from the South and went to Emory and is very familiar with this, like, Patagonia wearing, skull dipping, rapey jackass. And I mean, allegedly, whatever. But these people seem corrupt and hateful. Like, even the young ones who sort of didn't have a chance to be anything else because they're local royalty. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing, and I'm not saying it's something to be proud of on my part, but I do think it is very smart of the filmmakers, who I believe are not from the States, to somehow tap into that like wrong Carolina privilege Schadenfreude thing that is happening in at least two viewers who were like, are we still watching because we want petards to be a hoisting? Possibly, but we can only be what we are. And I'm wondering if you guys got the sense that this is a story that is, like, maybe better handled by people who are not from the States.
Yes.
I mean, are they Israeli? I may be talking out of my...
They're either Scandinavian or Israeli. They do. They make very interesting work. It's what is it that intrigues them, that outside eye? So we do hear the producer's voices a couple of times, the filmmaker's voices a couple of times. And the slight jolt of the fact that they don't have American accents, I think, is very fresh. And the questions that they ask can be very apparently simple. Mm-hmm. So that the residents and the Murdaugh defenders, of which they found plenty, which really surprised me, and the Murdaugh and the anti-Murdaughs, were eager to explain how things are. There's a lot of that's just the way things are. And if everyone nods, nobody says anything more. But if a foreigner says, oh, and why are they like that? Or how are they like that? Or what is the that they are like? I think they got some rather stunning, almost, I won't say confessions, because these people, the defenders, weren't accused of anything, but the lengths and the twists to which people who aren't attorneys went to defend this family was quite astonishing. Mari?
Yeah, they properly flush out the good old boy system, like the system of corruptness. I loved this one did have more residents talking about the Murdaughs, which I really appreciated. We got to speak to the family of the teenagers that were involved in the boat wreck. And one of the family members saying, like, oh, those boys were raised that the rules don't apply to them. Their mother raised them that the rules do not apply to them. Like, I was like stunned that they said that, you know, on camera, because that's something like we know, you know, if you've dealt with people of that like type of station. But she came out and said, yeah, their mother let them do whatever they wanted to. She let them get away with murder, literally, at this point.
Yeah, so, that was Beverly Cook. She's Anthony's mother, and he was on the boat, and Mallory Beach, the girl who died in the accident, in inverted commas, was his girlfriend, and he still says that Paul is a good guy. Mind you, this poor young man, Anthony, can barely open his lips to speak.
Yeah. I think that the filmmakers did a great job of bringing people in, talking to the people. Like, I was kind of okay with them bringing in the family lawyer and the friend and the people who could defend the Murdaughs. I didn't mind it. I didn't mind it. Like, you know,
no, me neither.
I sometimes I don't care about both sidesness, but I think this was a great docuseries to have the both sides of it in it. So I liked all of the talking heads a lot. I think the talking heads for me made this docuseries, because in comparison to other media that I've consumed about this case, I think they were lacking when it comes to a lot of the like the evidence. They didn't play nearly as much of the videos. They have so much video from that night.
That is so crazy. Yeah, jeez.
And they showed a little bit of it, but there's so much. Like, that night is literally documented almost minute by minute, because the kids were like on Snapchat. Mm-hmm. And it's very eerie. It's very interesting. If you go into that, if you start with that first crime there. And I wish they had kind of gotten into a little bit more, but it's okay. You know, I think you definitely get the gist of what they're implicating. Like, the kids went out, they were drinking excessively. Paul, you know, we say allegedly Paul might not have been behind the wheel, but again, like I said, it's very heavily documented that it was him. He was the one behind the wheel when they collided into the boat. The problem is he never got his day in court, because he was murdered before his trial could commence. So, but talking to Anthony Cook and having him relive, you know, his girlfriend's death was really sad, but I think it was really poignant, because Anthony Cook has been in a lot, some of these other documentaries. And I think it's his grief that really like puts the viewers on that boat that night, in a sense, because he talks about how he tried desperately to get Paul to like not drive. Him and his other friend Connor, who was also on the boat, I think they're related in some way.
They're both called Cook, but there are common surnames, I think, in Low Country. So I'm not sure if they're related.
Yeah, I think in the other one they anyways, we'll see.
They're like second cousins. They're cousins. Or something.
Oh, yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, they're cousins. Yeah, they both tried to drive and take, you know, take control away from Paul before the accident, but it just, he would not let them. So I say all that to say, I like the Talking Heads. I like the opener of how Low Country started. And again, this is how the case unfolds. You know, this is what happened in 2019. But the reason why we go back and we jump back to 2015 is because this case in 2019 is actually what sparks the reopening of Stephen Smith's case in 2015. And then after Paul and Maggie die in 2021, that reopens the 2018 case in the housekeeper's death. So it's like, it's really interesting, the jumping back and forth. And I always appreciate when they do it like this, because like you guys said, with the microfiche, they did it in a way that I was able to follow along and it made sense. But, you know, I wonder if Sarah, if this was your first time learning about this case, was it as easy to follow for you as to why they were jumping like that?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was familiar with the case. I just hadn't consumed, like, I haven't listened to that podcast yet. I didn't watch the ID thing. This was just my first sort of like packaged exposure to the case. And they do some interesting things with timeline that I think in order to give you a sense of like where we started and how it's going, but you know, not to be flip, but like that you're starting and then jumping back, like that can be a really kind of corny thing that tabloid news magazines do, that they have to do it here and they have to start with that 911 call that ends up being Vogue, which generally speaking, like these are genre cliches that I will mark off for, but they have no choice and they employ them really intelligently, I think. And this is an extremely complicated case that I wanted more, because whatever the reason is for the watchability, it is really watchable. But I think that they probably know best, like God knows how much footage they have, but I think it was selected, you know, advisedly and wisely. And I think they probably thought, like, in order for this not to be the Nicholas Nickleby of true crime documentaries, and when we don't even have, like, the trial hasn't even started yet, we have to have a narrow, like, focus on what we want to do. And I think it was successful. And they're, you know, sometimes documentarians just have to look at the story and be like, this story's a banger and I'm just going to assemble it and get out of its way. And I think that they did that really well.
Yeah, I think the time shifting was very advised and very clear. I mean, again, I had listened to the podcast, but my memory had, I remembered bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. So in telling it in a non-linear fashion is a choice. We have had sometimes that happen, like with Gabby Petito, where we followed it in the order that things were known rather than the order that things happened. And we found that very successful.
Yep.
Here, it's not quite that. But as we anchored this 911 call on the deaths of Maggie and Paul, and we jumped back from it and then forward and back and forward, I felt in very safe hands. I mean, if nothing else, these documentarians are competent. And I don't say that as a knock. I say thank you. Thank you for taking me by the hand and leading me so well. So it's a three-parter. To me, episode two is quite different. And I wonder if it's because the standout is that the victim's family speak. We get the backstory of Stephen Smith, who was unfortunately killed at the age of 19. What was it about episode two that struck you, if it did strike you, as different, Sarah?
I don't know if it struck me as different. Like sometimes with these docuseries, because of the fact that like these aren't just documentary sort of in space, like they're gonna get network notes. And I'm sure that happened here, that they were like, you have to do that sizzle reel for your own thing that people are already watching up top. That wasn't egregious here. Mm-hmm. But there is a little bit of like, not throat clearing, but just like, just in case you've recently arrived from, I don't know, space or never heard of true crime before, here's this, you know, here's the backstory. But I was struck by in the second episode, and just sort of generally when they were talking to whoever it was, whether it was victims' families and like victims' parents, but also attorneys, friends of the family, whoever it was. And this was present in these highway forensics experts that mm-hmm. sounds made up to me, but we could talk about that later if you want. But they gave, there was room for people to respond and for silences to stretch out. And sometimes in these documentaries, people sound, especially sometimes like parents who have become activists as a result of a certain manner of tragic death of their child, that it can sound a little prepared or rehearsed because they feel like they need to get their story out in an efficient manner and be heard. This felt much more organic and not that kind of like her smile lit up a room thing that you sometimes get on Dateline. And you really got a sense of these people and who they were, how they felt, and the parents in particular, just their like the exhaustion of loss and of a loss that was caused by a like power broker in your town, where it's like, on top of that, who, like, to whom do we complain? Like, we're screwed, basically. So I think that the documentary really did give a good sense of the interviewees, like the talking heads. You weren't just talking heads. Like, you got a mm-hmm. little bit of context for like them and their thoughts on things that was fresh. Like, you don't always get that. You don't always sort of get a sense of like, all right, I feel like I know what this guy was listening to in the car on the way here. And that's actually not nothing, especially when like the three of us do. You're watching a lot of stuff and listening to a lot of stuff in the genre. And when there's something a little different or that lets you sort of branch off into a different part of the story in your own mind, that's, I mean, you don't want to say refreshing in a like gothic tragedy like this, yeah. But it's notable, let's say.
Striking. Yes, I mean, we hear from Mike Hemlep. He was a particular standout for me. He was the Smith family attorney, but he also gave, he's obviously a local man, and he gave a great overview of growing up gay in the South at his age, and then at Stephen's age, it being different, but still as dangerous. And for the first time, we get law enforcement who are outside the county reach, shall we say, because the death occurred on the highway. Mari, episode 2, how did it strike you?
Oh, man. I loved the execution of it because it felt like you were stepping into a different world. So for me, that first episode and dealing with the horrendous death of Mallory Beach, it felt like we're still in the upper crust of society. We're in the upper crust of low country. All of these families feel like they're the top of that, you know, with the six of the friends that are in this boat, and you know, they were popular in high school. You know what I'm saying? You know, they mm-hmm. were those kids.
And yeah, Passion Mixon, the amazingly named Passion Mixon, tells us they were the popular kids.
Exactly. And then when you step into episode 2, I think the Stephen's cousin, Ashley Carroll, says it like, we're the poor people. It doesn't matter if anything happens to us. They don't care. And you could feel that talking to those people. You felt like you stepped into like, this is what it's actually like for everybody else who's not rich, whose parents mm-hmm. aren't rich, who aren't, you know, heavily tied to law enforcement and government and pulling strings and the powerful percent, you know, top 1% of that area. These were the hardworking people who these upper crust are stealing from, which we find out in episode three. So yeah. I could feel the shift, and I felt the weight of Steven's death here was handled. I don't know if I should say beautifully in a way, because it really pushed him forward. You know, we love when the victim is made into a whole person, and it didn't feel like he was, you know, a side piece to the Murdaugh's corruption. It felt like he was a whole person. Having his twin sister here telling us how it was for him to grow up gay in that part of the South, it was really touching. And again, I hate to keep going back and forth and comparing the two docuseries, but if I thought that the other docuseries did the first part better with the kids, I think this docuseries did the second part better, about Steven's death better. Even when Sarah gave me the heads up, like, oh, there's going to be crime scene photos. You know, we want to always warn our listeners. There were crime scene photos for Steven. It is blurred out. But I thought they did this even better, too, because they explained showing the crime scene photos, like, this could not possibly be a hit and run. Lieutenant Thomas Moore of the Highway Patrol, he said when he came up, they already had, like, you know, the state police were already there. The coroner was already there. I can't remember if he was the one who said that the Murdaughs were there too already, but but Highway Patrol, he was saying, like, as soon as he got to the crash site, he's looking at the crash site and he's like, this is not a hit and run. This is not us. And so one thing, I don't know if it came across clearly in this docuseries, but Thomas Moore was like, this is not our jurisdiction. Like, it was because he was like, this was not a highway accident. This should be looked into as a murder, as a homicide. But the coroner, and I think Sled eventually takes over and reopens the case, they initially rule it a hit and run, like an accident, in a sense, a car accident. So they give it to them, and he's like, I can't do anything with this because I'm looking at the crime scene. There's no pieces from a car. You're only saying that it's a hit and run because Steven's body was found directly in the middle of the road, which doesn't make sense either for like a hit and run. And then they go over.
There's like a whole variety of people who ran over him and kept going. I mean, so many
cracks. No glass, no skid marks. His phone was in his pocket. His shoes were still on. I sound like I know what I'm talking about, but this is the former MATE officer, nicely named, multidisciplinary accident investigation team, Corporal Michael Duncan. And he takes us through all the reasons why this was not a hit and run. He still had his shoes on. He said, I do not know of people who are hit by cars who keep their shoes on. So, here is where you could imagine the Murdaughs starting to crumble, because outside law enforcement is watching, but that was not the case.
Yeah, because unfortunately, like, it's really interesting because technically Steven, like, the way Steven's body is positioned, it's found like in the middle of the night, like 4 a.m., I think, or something like that. Yes.
He didn't tumble.
Exactly. The only reason why they even start to look at the Murdaughs is because all of a sudden Randy Murdaugh, which is Alex's brother, they show up at the crime scene. They're trying to like help. They're trying to help and stick their nose into it. They're like, what's happening?
Put their DNA there.
They just start poking their noses into it. And then all of a sudden, I think it's the Highway Patrol are still doing their investigation. Somebody's still doing the investigation. They keep saying all these rumors start bubbling to the surface. People keep saying Buster Murdaugh. He had something to do with it. It's just whispers. People are like kind of scared to go to the police, but they're like, from what we understand, we think it's Buster. And then we have Ashley, Steven's cousin, like, well, Steven told me shortly before he died that he was like he was probably sneaking around with somebody who's prominent in the community. And it's very sad when you see stuff like this, like the whole, you know, it's always the undercover, the closet guys who like kills their lovers. It's so sad to see that, because that happens so often in the gay community. And it seems like they're saying this might be it. They're saying that Steven may allegedly have had an affair with Buster, and that in order to keep the affair quiet, that Buster, maybe his brother Paul as well, who was the one who was indicted in the boat accident, maybe they had cornered Stephen or somehow lured Stephen out at night and were the ones who may have like bludgeoned him to death with either a 2x4 or a bat. It's very sad, Ben. It's very sad. But Buster is the older son. And shortly after Stephen dies, Buster's gone. Like in none of these documentaries is Buster ever like really featured. They have maybe a handful of photos of him. He's like an enigma. And it is so scary to think that you could have so much money. They're like, we don't know where he went. Like they think he went like overseas or something at one point, I think.
Yeah. Well, and here's another thing, like in this famously visual medium of podcasting, I just realized that I should maybe mention this, but like these people are all fiery gingers. Like there is, like, if you spotted one of them at a crime scene, it's not something you're going to have mistaken. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, Frecklore was definitely there. Like just funny sort of twist to this that like, you know, are witness IDs and a lineup reliable? Not necessarily, but when it comes to this family, yes. Absolutely. And they all look alike, basically.
They look very alike. I mean, the murderers managed to turn up at all these crime scenes, often before the crime scene has been opened up again. It was a murder family vehicle which towed the boat that was in the accident. And as somebody archly says, you would think that the county would have trailers. They certainly have plenty of boats. So there is always this, there's always and continuously this involvement of murderers, old and young, at every crime scene and in every investigation. In the first episode, we have stunning footage, very clear footage in the corridors of the hospital of a very busy father and grandfather of Paul bustling around, talking to people, going into rooms, and as Anthony's parents say, not asking them how they are and how they're doing. That's not what they were asking. They were persuading Connor to say that he didn't remember who was driving, so which is why we keep saying Paul was allegedly driving. And we will never have that confirmed because he didn't get to court, but certainly the first 911 call said Paul was driving. So let's just have a pull back now and talk about a couple of talking heads that interested me and any that interested you. I feel that we had two narrators, shall we say, who I appreciated very much. And one of them was the reporter, Andrew Davis. By nature of being a reporter, obviously he's a good narrator, but he's certainly on the scene for many of them. And the other person who I feel really grounded us and gave us an overview and spoke so calmly yet passionately at the end was Justin Bamberg, a South Carolina attorney who takes us through the number of disenfranchised poor minorities who were ripped off by this family. So, Murray, what did you think about either or both of these two narrators?
I thought Andrew Wright, the reporter, I thought he was very like you said, you could tell he's done this before. I was like, okay, Andrew. I was like, I don't know. I was like, okay, I guess. But the other one, what was his name again, Sarah?
Justin Bamberg.
Justin Bamberg, oh my gosh, I loved him. Like he was really putting some spice into the documentary. In a sense, like I'm not gonna lie, he was the only black man in this documentary. He was really calling. He's like he was cussing. He was calling like this is bull crap. And then
so good.
And in episode 3, once like all of this unraveled, there's so many crimes we haven't even talked about that I'm sure we'll just tell you to go and watch the show. But like when we find out that Alec Murdaugh is like defrauding a lot of his clients out of like insurance money, like dead like estates and stuff like that. Every time he's saying another name and showing another picture and it's one black family after another, I'm just getting enraged because it is literally the richest of the rich stealing from the poorest people in their state. You know, I know they were poorer than him like, that's for sure. You know what I'm saying? So that stuff like that is so enraging to me. And it just is so evil to steal things from these people who it comes to them through injury or death. So they're not, it's not a good way to make money. They are suffering and the money is supposed to help them through their suffering. And then he's stealing on top of that. Like it was so like just jaw dropping. And Justin did a very interesting job of like really just turning that heat up on him and just like, this man is not good. Like this family, they suck, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said the names and showed the photographs slowly and with, he wanted us to see who they were, mm-hmm. and he wrote their names in block letters with what we mm-hmm. call a texter. I don't know what you call it, a marker. But he was writing their names down for us too, which I have never seen before and I thought mm-hmm. was stunning. Sarah?
Yeah, I thought that his controlled fury was just mm-hmm. the thing, because this documentary does have a way of kind of the way that it paces the context, like slowly you're getting more and more depth and dimension to everything that's going on. And when you finally are sort of returned to like the, you know, back here in the present where this fraud is being perpetrated, and it's kind of this amazing, like it's this sort of evil scheme that doesn't even mm-hmm. rise to the level of a scheme. Like he just used a different bank account name. Like it's one of those like hashtags. Sometimes they catch themselves. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, not only is it a really simplistic setup, but that means that he's just unbelievably arrogant, and it worked for a while. And then at the same time, nobody seems to know why this was happening or where the money went. Like,
oh, yep.
How that they're just like, so he stole X, and in order to spend all of that on cocaine that he actually did, he would have to be doing cocaine 22 hours a day or like whatever, you know, whatever algebra they did. Mm-hmm. But it was really striking that it's like, here's like all the things that we know indicate that this family is like spoiled beyond reclamation. Mm-hmm. And bad and corrupt, but then there's all this other stuff that we don't know.
Yeah,
and getting back to that sort of like runner that we have on our episodes together about like that the unsolved part of an unsolved mystery is like that thing that sort of keeps you watching, that you're like, maybe this property will be the one that has that piece of information in it. That's what a big part of what is compelling to me about this story generally, that it's like everything we know is extremely compelling and probably like not easy, but like it suggests a good documentary just by existing. Yeah, there's so much that we don't know still. And the people that they chose to deliver commentary and where they chose to put those people in the timeline of the story was perfect. And Bamberg, like I just wrote down like everything that he said, because the comments had a pH of like 1.5 and I was there for that. Yes, for sure.
He said that Alec had to have stolen about $10 million, mm-hmm. but that money was never found. I think they said that he had like a negative $100,000 like in his bank account or something like that. Like he was basically, they never found the money.
Yeah. Which like what, he put it in crypto. He had a gambling problem. He had a crypto offshore. Gambling problem.
It has to be offshore somewhere. You're telling me. And the reason he was able to do this, not so like complicated schemes, because he's friends with one of the people who own the bank in their area. Yeah. So it's like, so it's hidden somewhere. And then on top of that, them thinking that he killed his wife and his son because his wife was contemplating divorce. To me, again, like they kind of pointed out in this documentary, if she's contemplating divorce, the first thing she has to do is figure out what the assets are. Mm-hmm. And maybe she discovered his embezzlement. Maybe she discovered that he didn't have money. Maybe he found out she discovered that, you know, and that he then hid his money.
Maybe he just got ahead of her.
Yeah, like it's so, oh my God, it's so interesting.
But now here's the question. Why did he kill Paul also? Paul was a witness to him killing the mother, or he's just sick of Paul's drunk bullshit?
Yeah, it could be. They said it looked like Paul was the target and Maggie was the witness. Mm-hmm. But perhaps that was his calculation to make it look like revenge for Paul's, if he did it. Yeah, to make it look like it was revenge for Paul's actions.
I mean, yes. allegedly.
When do we think he pulled the trigger?
Yeah.
The trigger? I mean,
it was the dog.
Forensic chemist. Yes, it was the dog. These poor dogs, they're getting a very bad rap.
I think he paid somebody to do it. I think he definitely had a hand in it. I just think I can't see him being the one that actually pulled the trigger.
Chris Robinson, the forensic analyst, very chillingly describes what it would be like to stand over someone. He actually demonstrates it without a gun, but it's enough for me to just go cold of how you would have to be standing over someone for the headshots that were delivered, unfortunately, to these dead people. They were not necessarily good people.
I think Murray's probably right. He probably outsourced that. Kind of person at least have the courage of your completely evil convictions, but they never do.
Yeah. Okay, so updates to the crime. You will be shocked, perhaps not. In August of 2022, so some month or so ago as we sit here, a South Carolina-based former sex worker named Lindsay Edwards came forward with claims of violent sexual abuse and beatings by Alec Murdaugh. If you want to read the very graphic details, they are on Wikipedia. She says she was compelled to service Alec on at least four occasions by being held at gunpoint by her madam's bouncer. Edward's testimony could prove pivotal before a jury as it goes to the nature of a person.
Mm. Yikes.
I want the dynasty. They didn't give us the dynasty. I want to go back and see whatever we thought of House of Hammer. It did trace back. I think that is the missing bit, is those first two generations. So let's go to our ratings. Sarah, how many magnifying glasses are you going to give Low Country out of a possible five?
Out of a possible five, four and a half. Because, you know, as I was sitting down to write about it, I was like, I can't really exactly explain why I think this is compelling. And I'm not sure it's the property itself. But first of all, I think it mostly is. And as we've been talking about it, I think I've clarified for myself that there are a lot of sort of invisible hand things happening here, that this build is actually very skillful and thoughtful in all the senses of that word. So I think before this discussion, I might have settled at a four, but I'm going to say a four and a half because I really couldn't stop watching it. I couldn't stop talking about it with various people, including my esteemed colleague, Mark. And I was super excited to talk about it with you guys. And I hope that there's going to be a part four once there's some court proceedings or decisions. Like, I am shocked that this freckly jackass allegedly is just gonna let it play out. Like, you gotta plead, buddy, but that's Southern white guys for you. So I'm interested to see if there's a follow-up. I think these filmmakers are really good, and this was the correct length. I wanted more, which is always a recommendation, so it's not perfect, but I'm gonna go four and a half. I was pleased with it and happy to be thinking about it.
Oh, that's high praise indeed. Mari, what about you? What are you going to give Low Country out of a possible five magnifying glasses?
I'm going to give it a four. I thought Low Country was great. I thought the three series were good. Like SDB said, I turned it on and I finished it in one sitting. Easy watch, even knowing what was going to happen. Easy watch. I think they did a good job of using some of the 911 calls. And like I said, I like the crime scene photos. I do feel like they went to Alex's 911 call they dipped back to that a few times. Okay, we get it. He sounds crazy. It was okay. I do feel like I slightly prefer the first one. I tried to rewatch that before I watched this. I only got to watch the first episode. So I still prefer, like, if I'm going a one-to-one, I think I prefer the first episode of the Murders, Deadly Dynasty. I prefer the second one of this, of Low Country. And I think the third one and both of them just both feel incomplete because the story is incomplete, you know? So I think they're tied. So I like them both. I want to give this a 4 out of 5 because it's not as perfect as some of the other properties that we've watched. But I think this is a really good watch, an interesting watch. It's so compelling. If you don't know the case, if you do know the case, it truly grips you. That's a good point.
It's good for even if you do know the case, like it goes both ways. Or if you don't know anything about it, it's very clear in terms of taking you through it. So
exactly,
works for both.
Exactly. Very, very clear about taking you through it. So, Sarah, what about you?
Yes, I'm a 4.5. I think I was a 4.5 at the beginning, as we started talking. And Sarah, you said, is it that the story is compelling or is it that the documentary is compelling? I thought, oh, I might have to knock down my rating, but I'm knocking it back up to a 4.5. I think the selection of the talking heads was very, very judicious. The breathing time they gave in the talking to these people, allowing them to speak, allowing Stephen Smith's mother to have her jigsaw puzzle there in front of her with her hands resting on it, I think was somehow a kindness. I don't know why it was like an emotional support jigsaw puzzle. I've never seen a documentary so far that has used chyrons as part of the narrative. Usually the chyron says, this is so-and-so, and this is their job. Here we saw the name of the person, and revelation is slightly a strong word, but the revelation of who they were they a resident, were they an attorney, then the family attorney comes up, and you actually start to see the story unfolding as well. So we start to talk to the Smiths, and then we get their attorney. So you go, ah, okay, so there were legal, I mean, of course there are, we know that. Mm-hmm. So I liked the use of chyrons. We don't like 911 calls. We don't like crime scene photos. But in this case, both of those were used very, very judiciously. The use of the CCTV footage, Paul should be in jail for smoking at a petrol station anyway. First thing I noticed in minute two was a cigarette at a petrol station. Idiot.
Like he could have been a fireball and much of this could have been avoided. Or not.
So I think in terms of recommending something or not, if you just jump to the recommendations, which we give you a time stamp for in the show notes, I think we're all saying, yes, watch it. 4.5 from me, 4.5 from Sarah, and 4 from Mari. Sarah, what do you have to recommend to our listeners today?
Oh, gosh. Well, I just watched this documentary that was making the festival rounds about 10 years ago, and I think it didn't really get a ton of attention at the time. There were some reviews, but it's this interesting meta property, actually. It's called Booker's Place, A Mississippi Story, and it's about the filmmaker. His father made a documentary in the mid 60s for NBC about this guy Booker Wright, who was a sort of waiter at this Mississippi restaurant in Greenwood by day, and then at night he ran his own place on literally the other side of the tracks. Like the two were like within sight of each other. Wright ended up getting murdered, and many people felt that it was because he had spoken out about how things were for Black Greenwoodians in the mid-60s. And the way that this is structured, it's sort of a conversation between the father's work and the son's. Many of Booker Wright's kids and grandkids are on camera and are talking about that. There's a Q&A where the original film is screened, and the town, Black and white, is sort of coming together to try to like work through this with each other and just this really dangerous, horrible history of, you know, Klan doings and everything else that was happening in Greenland, Mississippi. And because everything is in black and white in this documentary, the lines sort of blur between how it used to be and how it kind of still is in certain parts of the Deep South. It was really an affecting documentary that is available on like Tubi. I know there's all these streaming services that you're like, that's made up. Like, that doesn't exist, but it is actually available for free or for rent in various places. And I was quite impressed that with this like massive issue, that this filmmaker just sort of took this extremely narrow slice, a small town and a like narrow band of this case, one man's murder, and managed to give a really sort of deep portrait of the story and of his story and his family story. So extremely impressive. Not an easy sit, of course, but it's an hour and a half long. I'll send a link for the show notes. But again, it's called Booker's Place, and I recommend it. And I also recommend, if you are into true crime and you like secondhand true crime, previously owned, you can visit my bookshop 24/7. It's online. It's called Exhibit B Books. And if you can hear the sound of my voice, you can use a promo code XCS15 for 15% off.
Wonderful. Yes. Thank you so much. Christmas is coming, everybody. Who do you know who likes true crime?
Yep. Gift cards count. Just saying.
And Mari, do you have recommendations for us?
Yes, I do. Like we were saying, the Murdaugh Murders podcast by Mandy Matney and Liz Farrell. They are the like they are in South Carolina. I think it's Mandy who's like she was a reporter who kind of like was following all of these crimes as they were like breaking.
Wow.
Yeah.
Imagine being there as these things unfold.
As they were unfolding, she was
breaking them. Yeah, you would need like, a crazy wall for sure.
Yes.
There's 70 episodes, and Mandy and Liz Farrell, they are currently still following the case, like as of like a few weeks ago. They're going through the trial documents right now. So
ooh,
if you
okay.
to date, like what is happening in this case, blow by blow, definitely follow the Murdaugh Murders podcast. Like they are going over the three latest documents filed by Alex Murdaugh's defense team, his Alex notice of his alibi defense, a 95-page motion to compel the state to produce details on the DNA analysis and spatter evidence, and then another one-page motion to compel the state to produce more details on the same evidence. Like they are breaking it all down. So go check that out if you want to know what's continuing with this crime. Also, like I said, this will be in the show notes for the 18th time of the Murdaugh Murders, A Deadly Dynasty. It's found on Discovery Plus, and it is also a three-parter. So those are my recommendations. If you just need more of this content, because there's a lot. There's a lot we didn't go through. There is at least two more murders we didn't really talk about.
We didn't talk about rehab. As a way of getting out of jail.
Yeah. You know. Oh God. Yeah.
The murder.
I think
of
there's
the
more. I think there's like a docudrama coming that has yet to be cast, but they announced it recently. Like this. I mean, there's so much room for storytelling in this case. But I have had that podcast recommended to me several times, and I'm definitely going to check it out.
Yes, it's very good, and it's paced really well. They break it down where it's like, okay, we're talking about this part of the case now. Okay, now we're jumping to Steven's case. Okay, now we're jumping back to like Paul and Maggie's case. It's very, very interesting. So, and you can actually like I said, you don't have to listen to all of them. You can actually jump around if you just want to hear more in depth on each case and each mysterious death that surrounds this really interesting family. And then I think she goes back and talks about some of the older generations as well. So I mean, it's a lot of content out there. Sarah, what about you? What's your recommendation?
Well, I'm going to recommend an excellent series on 10 Play in Australia. It's a two-parter. It's called Claremont, Claremont. Australia doesn't have many famous serial killers. You know, there's John Justin Bunting, for example.
Speaking of forensic genealogy, no relation.
Exactly, no relation. But the killing of young women in the Perth suburb of Claremont in the mid to late 1990s led to, among other things, a mass DNA swabbing of most Perth men. So almost every man in Perth was swabbed for DNA, including every single taxi driver. It remained unsolved until 2020. It is now solved and the person is incarcerated. Watch it on 10play. It's worth a plane trip to Australia to see it. It's extremely well done and I would love for it to be available more widely because I'd love Murray and I to talk about it.
That may be something that comes to like a topic. Or one of those, or not BritBox, but like one of those sort of like all English language fictional and nonfiction crime streamers. So I will keep an eye out, but perhaps I will quote fly to Australia.
As I said before, this was an old unsolved case, as the lead detective said. It was never cold. They were always thinking about it. At Crime Scene, we're eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for further episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP, that's Scene, S-E-E-N, or email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com.
We're also on TikTok. You can follow Crime Scene on TikTok by going to TikTok and searching at crime.scene. That's at crime.S-E-E-N. And we're also on Instagram at Crime Scene Podcast.
Sarah, what have you got going on and where can people find you?
You can find my reviews of Booker's Place, of Low Country. I was about to say Murdaugh Country, like it's a Marlboro ad. Well, no, of Low Country and of all sorts of other things, true crime past and present, at Best Evidence FYI, which is the true crime newsletter that I write with my friend Eve Beatty. And we are on social everywhere at Best Evidence FYI. And the bookshop is on social everywhere at Exhibit B Books.
Terrific. Murray, where can the people find you and what do you have going on?
Well, of course, you can find me on Twitter at Murray Talks Too Much. That's two like the number two. Every week, me and Matt Scott go over the highlights of the week in wrestling over on the Wrestling Rehab Up podcast. We just did a review of the Survivor Series premium live event. You can check that out by going to robhasawebsite.com/wrestlingfeed to go subscribe to the Wrestling Rehab Up podcast. We will be doing like the year end Atlanta recap for post-show recaps. We'll be doing Atlanta a year in review. So just go and follow me on Twitter. So when when that drops, you'll know where to find it. So that's it for me. Sarah, where can people find you?
Well, while we are still tweeting, you can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine. Catch me over on Silent Podcasts. I'll be recapping the latest episode of The Amazing Race. It was an incredible episode in Iceland, and we're down to the final three, and I want them all to win. I've never felt like that on an Amazing Race before. Over on Post Show Recaps, I'm covering Welcome to Chippendales with Jason Reed, so you can hear us talking about that every week. And also on Post Show Recaps, I will be doing the year in review on shows that I've covered this year, Bridgerton and Our Flag Means Death. So, Murray, what are we talking about next week?
Next time on Crime Scene, we're watching Killer Sally with special guest Omer Zaheer. Watch it on Netflix and send us your comments and questions.
Awesome. Thanks to our inaugural four-timer, Sarah D. Bunting, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Will from America for the theme music, Tricky Rice for the graphics, and Chelsea Lesser and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time, case closed.
Closed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.